We are also good at analogy, taking new situations and identifying other circumstances that are similar enough to be useful in a new environment. For example, scientists imagined the atom as a miniature solar system for decades, and it is still taught that way in many schools. While computer scientists are working to reduce machines' data needs, developing techniques such as one-shot learning, in which machines learn to predict an object well after seeing it just once, current prediction machines are not yet adequate. Because these are known unknowns, and because humans are still better at decisions in the face of known unknowns, the people managing the machine know that such situations may arise, and thus they can program the machine to call a human for help. Unknown unknowns. In order to predict, someone needs to tell a machine what is worth predicting. If something has never happened before, a machine cannot predict it, at least without a human's careful judgment to provide a useful analogy that allows the machine to predict using information about something else. Nassim Nicholas Taleb emphasizes unknown unknowns in his book The Black Swan. He highlights that we cannot predict truly new events from past data. The book's title refers to the Europeans' discovery of a new type of swan in Australia. To 18th century Europeans, swans were white. Upon arrival in Australia, they saw something totally new and unpredictable: black swans. They had never seen black swans, and therefore had no information that could predict the existence of such a swan. Taleb argues that the appearances of other unknown unknowns have important consequences, unlike the appearance of black swans, which had little meaningful impact on the direction of European or Australian society. For example, the 1990s were a good time to be in the music industry. CD sales were growing and revenue climbed steadily. The future looked bright. Then, in 1999, 18-year-old Sean Fanning developed Napster, a program that allowed people to share music files for free over the internet. Soon, people had downloaded millions of such files, and music industry revenues began to fall. The industry still hasn't recovered. Fanning was an unknown unknown. Machine prediction could not predict his arrival. Admittedly, as Taleb and others emphasized, humans are also relatively bad at predicting unknown unknowns. Faced with unknown unknowns, both humans and machines fail. Unknown knowns. Perhaps the biggest weakness of prediction machines is that they sometimes provide wrong answers that they are confident are right. As we describe above, in the case of known unknowns, humans understand the inaccuracy of the prediction. The prediction comes with a confidence range that reveals its imprecision. In the case of unknown unknowns, humans don't think they have any answers. In contrast with unknown knowns, prediction machines appear to provide a very precise answer, but that answer can be very wrong. How does that occur? Because while data informs decisions, data can also come from decisions. If the machine does not understand the decision process that generated the data, its predictions can fail. For example, suppose you are interested in predicting whether you will use prediction machines in your organization. You are off to a good start. It turns out that reading this book is almost surely an excellent predictor of being a manager who will use prediction machines. Why? For at least three possible reasons. First, and most directly, the insights in this book will prove useful. So the act of reading the book causes you to learn about prediction machines, and therefore to bring these tools into your business effectively. Second is a reason called reverse causality. You are reading this book because you already use prediction machines, or have definite plans to do so in the near future. The book didn't cause the technology adoption. Instead, the perhaps pending technology adoption caused you to read this book. Third is a reason called omitted variables. You are the kind of person who is interested in technological trends and management. Therefore, you decided to read this book. You also use new technologies, such as prediction machines, in your work. In this case, your underlying preferences for technology and management caused both the book reading and the use of prediction machines. Sometimes this distinction does not matter. If all you care about is knowing whether a person reading this book will adopt prediction machines, then it doesn't matter what causes what. If you see someone reading this book, then you can make an informed prediction that such a person will use prediction machines in their work. Sometimes this distinction does matter. If you are thinking of recommending this book to your friends, you will do so if it caused you to be a better manager with respect to prediction machines. What would you like to know? You'd start with the fact that you read the book. Then you'd like to peer into the future and observe how well you do in managing AI. Suppose you see the future perfectly. You have been fabulously successful at managing prediction machines. It becomes core to your organization, and you and your organization succeed beyond your wildest dreams. Can you then say that reading this book caused that success? No. To figure out if reading this book had an impact, you also need to know what would have happened if you hadn't read this book. You don't have that data. You need to observe what economists and statisticians call the counterfactual. What would have happened if you took a different action? Determining whether an action causes an outcome requires two predictions. First, what outcome will happen after the action is taken, and second, what outcome would have happened had a different action been taken? But that's impossible. You will never have data on the action not taken. This is a recurrent problem for machine prediction. In his book, Deep Thinking, chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov discusses a related issue with an early machine learning algorithm for chess. When Mishi and a few colleagues wrote an experimental data-based machine learning chess program in the early 1980s, it had an amusing result. They fed hundreds of thousands of positions from grandmaster games into the machine, hoping it would be able to figure out what worked and what did not. At first, it seemed to work. Its evaluation of positions was more accurate than conventional programs. The problem came when they let it actually play a game of chess. The program developed its pieces, launched an attack, and immediately sacrificed its queen. It lost in just a few moves, having given up the queen for next to nothing. Why did it do it? Well, when a grandmaster sacrifices his queen, it's nearly always a brilliant and decisive blow. To the machine, educated on a diet of GM games, giving up its queen was clearly the key to success. The machine reversed the causal sequence. Without understanding that grandmasters sacrifice the queen only when doing so creates a short and clear path to victory, the machine learned that winning occurs shortly after sacrificing the queen. So, sacrificing the queen wrongly appears to be the way to win. While this particular issue in machine prediction has been solved, reverse causality remains a challenge for prediction machines. This issue appears frequently in business, too. In many industries, low prices are associated with low sales. For example, in the hotel industry, prices are low outside the tourist season, and prices are high when demand is highest and hotels are full. Given that data, a naive prediction might suggest that increasing the price would lead to more rooms sold. A human, at least one with some training in economics, would understand that the price changes are likely caused by the high level of demand, not vice versa. So increasing price is unlikely to increase sales. This human can then work with the machine to identify the right data, such as individual level choices of hotel rooms based on price, and appropriate models that take into account seasonality and other demand and supply factors to better predict sales at different prices. Thus, to the machine, this is an unknown known. But a human with an understanding of how prices are determined will see this as a known unknown, or perhaps even a known known, if the human can properly model the pricing decision. The issue of unknown knowns and causal inference is even more important in the presence of others' strategic behavior. Google's search results come from a secret algorithm. That algorithm is largely determined by prediction machines that predict which links someone is likely to click. For a website manager, a higher ranking means more visitors to the website and more sales. Most website managers recognize this and perform search engine optimization. They adapt their websites to try to improve their ranking in Google's search results. These adaptations are often ways to game idiosyncratic aspects of the algorithm. So, as time passes, the search engine becomes filled with spam, links that are not what the person searching really wanted, but instead the results of website managers gaming the quirks in the algorithm. Prediction machines do a great job in the short run in terms of predicting what people will click. But after weeks or months, enough website managers find ways to game the system that Google needs to substantially change the prediction model. This back and forth between the search engine and the search engine spammers occurs because the prediction machine can be gamed. While Google has tried to create a system that makes such gaming unprofitable, it also recognizes the weaknesses of relying fully on prediction machines and uses human judgment to re-optimize the machine in the face of such spam. Instagram is also in a constant battle with spammers, updating the algorithms it uses to regularly catch spam and offensive material. More generally, once humans have identified such problems, they are no longer unknown knowns. Either they find solutions to generate good predictions, so the problems become known knowns that may require humans and machines to work together, or they cannot find solutions, so they become known unknowns. Machine prediction is extremely powerful, but has limitations. It does not perform well with limited data. Some well-trained humans can recognize these limitations, whether because of rare events or causal inference problems, and improve the machine predictions. To do so, those humans need to understand the machine. Predicting better together. Sometimes the combination of humans and machines generates the best predictions, each complementing the other's weaknesses. In 2016, a Harvard-MIT team of AI researchers won the Chameleon Grand Challenge, a contest that produces computer-based detection of metastatic breast cancer from slides of biopsies. The team's winning deep learning algorithm made the correct prediction 92.5% of the time, compared with a human pathologist whose performance was at 96.6%. While this seemed like a victory for humanity, the researchers went further and combined the predictions of their algorithm and a pathologist's. The result was an accuracy of 99.5%. That is, the human error rate of 3.4% fell to just 0.5%. Errors fell by 85%. This is a classic division of labor, but not physically, as Adam Smith described. Rather, it is a cognitive division of labor that economist and computer pioneer Charles Babbage initially described in the 19th century. The effect of the division of labor, both in mechanical and mental processes, is that it enables us to purchase and apply precisely the quantity of skill and knowledge which is required for it. The human and the machine are good at different aspects of prediction. The human pathologist was usually right when saying there was cancer. It was unusual to have a situation in which the human said there was cancer but was mistaken. In contrast, the AI was much more accurate when saying the cancer wasn't there. The human and the machine made different types of mistakes. By recognizing these different abilities, combining human and machine prediction overcame these weaknesses, so their combination dramatically reduced the error rate. How does such collaboration translate into a business environment? Machine prediction can enhance the productivity of human prediction via two broad pathways. The first is by providing an initial prediction that humans can use to combine with their own assessments. The second is to provide a second opinion after the fact, or a path for monitoring. In this way, the boss can ensure the human is working hard and putting effort into the prediction. In the absence of such monitoring, the human may not work hard enough. The theory is that humans who must answer for why their prediction differed from an objective algorithm might only overrule machines if they put in extra effort to ensure they are sufficiently confident. One excellent place to examine such interactions is the prediction regarding the creditworthiness of loan applicants. Daniel Paravicini and Antoinette Shore examined a Colombian bank's evaluation of small enterprise loan applicants after the introduction of a new credit scoring system. The computerized scoring system took a variety of information about the applicants and aggregated it into a single measure that predicted risk. Then, a loan committee of bank employees used the score and their own processes to approve, reject, or refer the loan to a regional manager to decide. A randomized controlled trial, not management decree, determined whether the score was introduced before or after the decision. Thus, the score provided a good place to scientifically evaluate its impact on decision-making. One group of employees was provided the score just before they met to deliberate. This is analogous to the first way to collaborate with a machine, in which the machine prediction informs the human decision. Another group of employees was not given the score until after they had made an initial evaluation. This is analogous to the second way to collaborate with a machine, in which the machine prediction helps monitor the quality of the human decision. The difference between the first and second treatments was whether the score was providing information or not to the human decision makers. In both cases, the score helped, though the improvement was largest when the score was provided in advance. In that case, the committee made better decisions and asked the manager for help less often. The predictions empowered the lower-level managers by providing information. In the other case, when the committee had the score after, decision-making improved because the predictions helped the higher-level managers monitor the committees. It increased the incentives of the committee to ensure the quality of their decisions. For a human prediction machine pair to generate a better prediction requires an understanding of the limits of the human and the machine. In the case of the loan application committees, humans might make biased predictions, or they might shirk on effort. Machines might lack important information. While we often place an emphasis on teamwork and collegiality when humans collaborate, we might not think of human-machine pairs as teams. For humans to make machine prediction better, and vice versa, it is important to understand the weaknesses of both humans and machines and combine them in a way that overcomes these flaws. Prediction by exception. One major benefit of prediction machines is that they can scale in a way that humans cannot. One downside is that they struggle to make predictions in unusual cases for which there isn't much historical data. Combined, this means that many human-machine collaborations will take the form of prediction by exception. As we've discussed, prediction machines learn when data is plentiful, which happens when they are dealing with more routine or frequent scenarios. In these situations, the prediction machine operates without the human partner expending attention. By contrast, when an exception arises, a scenario that is non-routine, it is communicated to the human, and then the human puts in more effort to improve and verify the prediction. This prediction by exception is precisely what happened with the Colombian Bank Loan Committee. The idea of prediction by exception has its antecedents in the managerial technique of management by exception. In coming up with predictions, the human is, in many respects, the prediction machine's supervisor. A human manager has many difficult tasks. to economize on the human's time. The working relationship is to engage the human's attention only when really needed. That it is needed only infrequently means that one human can easily leverage a prediction machine's advantages in routine predictions. Prediction by exception is integral to how Chisel's initial product worked. Chisel's first product, which we discussed at the beginning of the chapter, took various documents and identified and redacted confidential information. This otherwise laborious procedure arises in many legal situations where documents may be disclosed to other parties or publicly, but only if certain information is hidden. The Chisel redactor relied on prediction by exception, taking a first pass at that task. In particular, a user could effectively set the redactor to be aggressive or light. An aggressive redactor's threshold for what might be blocked out would be higher than a lighter touch version. For instance, if you are worried about leaving confidential information unredacted, you choose an aggressive setting. But if you are worried about disclosing too little, you choose a lighter setting. Chisel provided an easy-to-use interface for a person to review redactions and accept or reject them. In other words, each redaction was a recommendation rather than a final decision. The ultimate authority still rested with the human. Chisel's product combines humans and machines to overcome the weaknesses of both. The machine works faster than a human and provides a consistent measure across documents. The human can intervene when the machine does not have enough data to make a good prediction. Key points. Humans, including professional experts, make poor predictions under certain conditions. Humans often overweight salient information and do not account for statistical properties. Many scientific studies document these shortcomings across a wide variety of professions. The phenomenon was illustrated in the feature film Moneyball. Machines and humans have distinct strengths and weaknesses in the context of prediction. As prediction machines improve, businesses must adjust their division of labor between humans and machines in response. Prediction machines are better than humans at factoring in complex interactions among different indicators, especially in settings with rich data. As the number of dimensions for such interactions grows, the ability of humans to form accurate predictions diminishes, especially relative to machines. However, humans are often better than machines when understanding the data generation process confers a prediction advantage, especially in settings with thin data. We describe a taxonomy of prediction settings, that is, known knowns, known unknowns, unknown knowns, and unknown unknowns. That is useful for anticipating the appropriate division of labor. Prediction machines scale. The unit cost per prediction falls as the frequency increases. Human prediction does not scale the same way. However, humans have cognitive models of how the world works and thus can make predictions based on small amounts of data. Thus, we anticipate a rise in human prediction by exception, whereby machines generate most predictions because they are predicated on routine, regular data. But when rare events occur, the machine recognizes that it is not able to produce a prediction with confidence, and so calls for human assistance. The human provides prediction by exception. Part 2. Decision-making. 7. Unpacking decisions. We typically associate decision-making with big decisions. Should I buy this house? Should I attend this school? Should I marry this person? No doubt these life-changing decisions, while rare, are important. But we also make small decisions all the time. Should I keep sitting in this chair? Should I keep walking down this street? Should I keep paying this monthly bill? And as the great Canadian rock band Rush quips in its anthem to free will, if you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. We handle many of our smaller decisions on autopilot, perhaps by accepting the default, choosing to focus all our attention on bigger decisions. However, deciding not to decide is still a decision. Decision-making is at the core of most occupations. School teachers decide how to educate their students, who have different personalities and learning styles. Managers decide who to recruit for their team and who to promote. Janitors decide how to deal with unexpected events such as spills and safety hazards. Truck drivers decide how to respond to route closures and traffic accidents. Police officers decide how to handle suspicious individuals and potentially dangerous situations. Doctors decide what medicine to prescribe and when to administer costly tests. Parents decide how much screen time is suitable for their children. Decisions like these usually occur under conditions of uncertainty. The teacher doesn't know for sure whether a particular child will learn better from one teaching approach or another. The manager doesn't know for sure whether a job applicant will perform well or not. The doctor doesn't know for sure whether it is necessary to administer a costly exam. Each of them must predict. But a prediction is not a decision. Making a decision requires applying judgment to a prediction, and then acting. Before recent advances in machine intelligence, this distinction was only of academic interest because humans always performed prediction and judgment together. Now, advances in machine prediction mean that we have to examine the anatomy of a decision. The anatomy of a decision. Prediction machines will have their most immediate impact at the decision level. But decisions have six other key elements. See Figure 7-1. When someone or something makes a decision, they take input data from the world that enables a prediction. That prediction is possible because training occurred about relationships between different types of data and which data is most closely associated with the situation. Combining the prediction with judgment on what matters, the decision maker can then choose an action. The action leads to an outcome, which has an associated reward or payoff. The outcome is a consequence of the decision. It is needed to provide a complete picture. The outcome may also provide feedback to help improve the next prediction. Imagine you have a pain in your leg and go to the doctor. The doctor sees you, takes an X-ray and a blood test, and asks you a few questions, resulting in input data. Using that input, and based on years in medical school and many other patients who are more or less like you, that's training and feedback, the doctor makes a prediction. You most likely have muscle cramps, although there is a small chance you have a blood clot. Figure 7-1, Anatomy of a Task. Alongside this assessment is judgment. The doctor's judgment takes into account other data, including intuition and experience. Suppose that, if it is a muscle cramp, then the treatment is rest. If a blood clot, then the treatment is a drug with no long-term side effects, but it causes mild discomfort for many people. If the doctor mistakenly treats your muscle cramp with the blood clot treatment, then you are uncomfortable for a short time. If the doctor mistakenly treats the blood clot with rest, then there is a chance of serious complications, or even death. Judgment involves determining the relative payoff associated with each possible outcome, including those associated with correct decisions, as well as those associated with mistakes. In this case, the payoffs associated with healing, mild discomfort, and serious complications. Determining the payoffs for all possible outcomes is a necessary step for deciding when to choose the drug treatment, opting for the mild discomfort, and reducing the risk of a serious complication, versus when to choose rest. So, applying judgment to the prediction, the doctor makes a decision, perhaps, given your age and risk preferences, that you should have the treatment for the muscle cramp, even though there is some tiny likelihood you have a blood clot. Finally is the action in administering the treatment and observing the outcome. Did the pain in your leg go away? Did other complications arise? The doctor can use this observed outcome as feedback to inform the next prediction. By breaking up a decision into elements, we can think clearly about which parts of human activities will diminish in value and which will increase as a result of enhanced machine prediction. Most clearly, for prediction itself, a prediction machine is generally a better substitute for human prediction. As machine prediction increasingly replaces the predictions that humans make, the value of human prediction will decline. But a key point is that while prediction is a key component of any decision, it is not the only component. The other elements of a decision, judgment, data, and action, remain for now firmly in the realm of humans. They are complements to prediction, meaning they increase in value as prediction becomes cheap. For example, we may be more willing to exert effort by applying judgment to decisions where we previously had decided not to decide. For example, accepted the default, because prediction machines now offer better, faster, and cheaper predictions. In that case, the demand for human judgment will increase. Losing the knowledge. The knowledge is the subject matter of a test that London cabbies take to drive the city's celebrated black taxis. The test involves knowing the location of thousands of points and streets around the city, and this is the harder part, predicting the shortest or fastest route between any two points at any time of day. The amount of information for even an ordinary city is staggering, but London is not ordinary. It is a mass of formerly independent villages and towns that have grown together over the past 2,000 years into a global metropolis. To pass the test, potential cabbies need a near-perfect score. Not surprisingly, passing the test takes, on average, 3 years, including not only time spent poring over maps, but also riding around the city on mopeds, memorizing and visualizing. But once they have achieved this, honored Green Badge recipients are a font of knowledge. You know where this story is going. A decade ago, London cab drivers' knowledge was their competitive advantage. No one could provide the same degree of service. People who would otherwise have walked would hop in a cab just because the cab drivers knew the way. But just 5 years later, a simple mobile GPS or satellite navigation system gave drivers access to data and predictions that had once been the cabbie's superpower. Today, the same superpowers are available for free on most mobile phones. People do not get lost. People know the fastest route. And now the phone is one step better because it is updated in real time with traffic information. Cabbies who invested 3 years of studying to learn the knowledge did not know they would someday be competing with prediction machines. Over the years, they uploaded maps into their memory, tested routes, and filled in the blanks with their common sense. Now, navigation apps have access to the same map data and are able, through a combination of algorithms and predictive training, to find the best route whenever requested, using real-time data about traffic that the taxi driver cannot hope to know. But the fate of London cabbies rested not just on the ability for navigation apps to predict the knowledge, but also on other crucial elements to take the best path from point A to point B. First, the cabbies could control a motor vehicle. Second, they had sensors affixed to them, their eyes and ears most importantly, that fed contextual data to their brains to ensure that they put their knowledge to good use. But so did other people. No London cabbie became worse at their job because of navigation apps. Instead, millions of other non-cabbies became a lot better. The cabbie's knowledge was no longer a scarce commodity, opening up cabbies to competition from ride-sharing platforms like Uber. That other drivers could show up with the knowledge on their phones and predictions of the fastest routes meant they could provide equivalent service. When high-quality machine prediction became cheap, human prediction declined in value, so the cabbies were worse off. The number of rides in London's black cabs fell. Instead, other people provided the same service. These others also had driving skills and human sensors, complementary assets that went up in value as prediction became cheap. Of course, self-driving cars might themselves end up substituting for those skills and senses, but we will return to that story later. Our point here is that understanding the impact of machine prediction requires an understanding of the various aspects of decisions, as described by the anatomy of a decision. Should you take an umbrella? Until now, we've been a little imprecise about what judgment actually is. To explain it, we introduce a decision-making tool, the decision tree. It is especially useful for decisions under uncertainty, when you are not sure what will happen if you make a particular choice. Let's consider a familiar choice you might face. Should you carry an umbrella on a walk? You might think that an umbrella is a thing you hold over your head to stay dry, and you'd be right. But an umbrella is also a kind of insurance, in this case, against the possibility of rain. So the following framework applies to any insurance-like decision to reduce risk. Clearly, if you knew it was not going to rain, you would leave the umbrella at home. On the other hand, if you knew it would rain, then you would certainly take it with you. In Figure 7-2, we represent this using a tree-like diagram. At the root of the tree are two branches representing the choices you could make: leave umbrella or take umbrella. Extending from these are two branches that represent what you are uncertain about: rain versus shine. Absent a good weather forecast, you do not know. You might know that, at this time of the year, sun is three times more likely than rain. This would give you a three-quarters chance of sun and a one-quarter chance of rain. This is your prediction. Finally, at the tips of the branches are the consequences. If you don't take an umbrella and it rains, you get wet, and so on. Figure 7-2. Should you take an umbrella? What decision should you make? This is where judgment comes in. Judgment is the process of determining the reward to a particular action in a particular environment. It is about working out the objective you're actually pursuing. Judgment involves determining what we call the reward function, the relative rewards and penalties associated with taking particular actions that produce particular outcomes, wet or dry, burdened by carrying an umbrella or unburdened. Let's assume that you prefer being dry without an umbrella. You rated a 10 out of 10. More than being dry, but carrying an umbrella, 8 out of 10, more than being wet. A big fat zero. See Figure 7-3. This gives you enough to act. With a prediction of rain one quarter of the time and the judgment of the payoffs to being wet or carrying an umbrella, you can work out your average payoff from taking versus leaving the umbrella. Based on this, you are better off taking the umbrella. An average payoff of 8, then leaving it. An average payoff of 7.5. Figure 7-3. Average payoff from taking or leaving an umbrella. If you really hate toting an umbrella, a 6 out of 10, your judgment about preferences can also be accommodated. In this case, the average payoff from leaving an umbrella at home is unchanged, at 7.5, while the payoff from taking one is now 6. So, such umbrella haters will leave the umbrella at home. This example is trivial. Of course, people who hate umbrellas more than getting wet will leave them home. But the decision tree is a useful tool for figuring out payoffs for non-trivial decisions, too. And that is at the heart of judgment. Here, the action is taking the umbrella. The prediction is rain or shine. The outcome is whether you get wet, and judgment is anticipating happiness you will feel, payoff, from being wet or dry, with or without an umbrella. As prediction becomes better, faster, and cheaper, we'll use more of it to make more decisions. So we'll also need more human judgment, and thus, the value of human judgment will go up. Key points. Prediction machines are so valuable because, 1, they can often produce better, faster, and cheaper predictions than humans can. 2, prediction is a key ingredient in decision-making under uncertainty. And 3, decision-making is ubiquitous throughout our economic and social lives. However, a prediction is not a decision. It is only a component of a decision. The other components are judgment, action, outcome, and three types of data: input, training, and feedback. By breaking down a decision into its components, we can understand the impact of prediction machines on the value of humans and other assets. The value of substitutes to prediction machines, namely human prediction, will decline. However, the value of complements, such as the human skills associated with data collection, judgment, and actions, will become more valuable. In the case of the London cabbies, who each invested 3 years to learn the knowledge, how to predict the fastest route from one location to another at a particular time of day, none became worse at their job because of prediction machines. Rather, many other drivers became a lot better at choosing the best route by using prediction machines. The cabbies' prediction skills were no longer a scarce commodity. Drivers who weren't cabbies had driving skills and human sensors, eyes and ears, that were effectively enhanced by prediction machines, enabling them to compete. Judgment involves determining the relative payoff associated with each possible outcome of a decision, including those associated with correct decisions, as well as those associated with mistakes. Judgment requires specifying the objective you're actually pursuing, and is a necessary step in decision-making. As prediction machines make predictions increasingly better, faster, and cheaper, the value of human judgment will increase, because we'll need more of it. We may be more willing to exert effort and apply judgment to decisions where we previously had chosen not to decide, by accepting the default. 8. The value of judgment. Having better prediction raises the value of judgment. After all, it doesn't help to know the likelihood of rain if you don't know how much you like staying dry or how much you hate carrying an umbrella. Prediction machines don't provide judgment. Only humans do, because only humans can express the relative rewards from taking different actions. As AI takes over prediction, humans will do less of the combined prediction-judgment routine of decision-making and focus more on the judgment role alone. This will enable an interactive interface between machine prediction and human judgment, much the same way that you run alternative queries when interacting with a spreadsheet or database. With better prediction come more opportunities to consider the rewards of various actions. In other words, more opportunities for judgment. And that means that better, faster, and cheaper prediction will give us more decisions to make. Judging fraud. Credit card networks such as MasterCard, Visa, and American Express predict and judge all the time. They have to predict whether card applicants meet their standards for creditworthiness. If the individual doesn't, then the company will deny them credit. You might think that's pure prediction, but a significant element of judgment is involved as well. Being creditworthy is a sliding scale, and the credit card company has to decide how much risk it's willing to take on at different interest and default rates. Those decisions lead to significantly different business models. The difference between American Express's high-end platinum card and an entry-level card aimed at college students. The company also needs to predict whether any given transaction is legitimate. As with your decision to carry an umbrella or not, the company must weigh four distinct outcomes. See Figure 8-1. The company has to predict if the charge is fraudulent or legitimate, decide whether to authorize or decline the transaction, and then to evaluate each outcome. Denying a fraudulent charge is good. Angering a customer with the denial of a legitimate transaction is bad. If the credit card companies were perfect at predicting fraud, all would be well. But they're not. Figure 8-1. For instance, Joshua, one of the authors, has had his credit card company routinely deny transactions when he is shopping for running shoes, something he does about once a year, usually at an outlet mall when he is on vacation. For many years, he had to call the credit card company to lift a restriction. Credit card theft often happens at malls, and the first few fraudulent purchases might be things like shoes and clothing, easy to convert into cash as returns at a different branch of the same chain. And since Joshua is not in the habit of routinely buying clothes and shoes, and rarely goes to a mall, the credit card company predicts that the card has likely been stolen. It's a fair guess. Some factors that influence the prediction about whether a card has been stolen are generic, the type of transaction, such as purchasing running shoes, while others are specific to individuals, in this case, age and frequency. That combination of factors means that the eventual algorithm that flags transactions will be complex. The promise of AI is that it can make prediction much more precise, especially in situations with a mix of generic and personalized information. For instance, given data on Joshua's years of transactions, a prediction machine could learn the pattern of those transactions, including the fact that he buys shoes around the same time each year. Rather than classifying such a purchase as an unusual event, it could classify it as a usual event for this particular person. A prediction machine may notice other correlations, such as how long it takes someone to shop, working out whether transactions in two different shops are too close together. As the prediction machine becomes more precise in flagging transactions, the card network can become more confident in imposing a restriction, and even whether to contact a consumer. This is already happening. Joshua's last outlet mall purchase of running shoes went smoothly. But until prediction machines become perfect at predicting fraud, credit card companies will have to figure out the costs of errors, which requires judgment. Suppose that prediction is imperfect and has a 10% chance of being incorrect. Then, if the companies decline the transaction, they will do the right thing with a 90% chance and save the network the costs of recovering the payment associated with the unauthorized transaction. But they also will decline a legitimate transaction with a 10% chance, leaving the network with a dissatisfied customer. To work out the right course of action, they need to be able to balance the costs associated with fraud discovery with the costs associated with customer dissatisfaction. Credit card companies don't automatically know the right answer to this trade-off. They need to figure it out. Judgment is the process of doing that. It's the umbrella case all over again. But instead of burdened, unburdened, and wet, dry, there are fraud charges and customer satisfaction. In this case, because this transaction is 9 times likelier to be fraudulent than legitimate, the company will deny the charge unless customer satisfaction is 9 times more important than the possible loss. For credit card fraud, many of these payoffs may be easy to judge. It is highly likely that the cost of recovery has a distinct monetary value that a network can identify. Suppose that for a $100 transaction, the recovery cost is $20. If the customer dissatisfaction cost is less than $180, it makes sense to decline the transaction. 10% of $180 is $18, the same as 90% of $20. For many customers, being declined for a single transaction does not lead to the equivalent of $180 in dissatisfaction. A credit card network also must assess whether that is likely to be the case for a particular customer. For example, a high net worth platinum card holder may have other credit card options and might stop using that particular card if declined, and that person may be on an expensive vacation. So the card network could lose all of the expenditures associated with that trip. Credit card fraud is a well-defined decision process, which is one reason we keep coming back to it. Yet, it's still complicated. By contrast, for many other decisions, not only are the potential actions more complex, not just a simple accept or decline, but the potential situations, or states, also vary. Judgment requires an understanding of the reward for each pair of actions and situations. Our credit card example had just 4 outcomes, or 8 if you distinguish between high net worth customers and everyone else. But if you had, say, 10 actions and 20 possible situations, then you're judging 200 outcomes. As things get even more complicated, the number of rewards can become overwhelming. The cognitive costs of judgment. People who have studied decisions in the past have generally taken rewards as givens. They simply exist. You may like chocolate ice cream while your friend may like mango gelato. How you two came to your different views is of little consequence. Similarly, we assume most businesses are maximizing profit or shareholder value. Economists looking at why firms choose certain prices for their products have found it useful to take those objectives on faith. Payoffs are rarely obvious, and the process of understanding those payoffs can be time-consuming and costly. However, the rise of prediction machines increases the returns to understanding the logic and motivation for payoff values. In economic terms, the cost of figuring out the payoffs will mostly be time. Consider one particular pathway by which you might determine payoffs: deliberation and thought. Thinking through what you really want to achieve or what the costs of customer dissatisfaction might be takes time spent thinking, reflecting, and perhaps asking others for advice. Or it may be the time spent researching to better understand payoffs. For credit card fraud detection, thinking through the payoffs of satisfied and unsatisfied customers and the cost of allowing a fraudulent transaction to proceed are necessary first steps. Providing different payoffs for high net worth customers requires more thought. Assessing whether those payoffs change when those customers are on vacation requires even more consideration. And what about regular customers when they are on vacation? Are the payoffs in that situation different? And is it worth separating work travel from vacation, or trips to Rome from trips to the Grand Canyon? In each case, judging the payoffs requires time and effort. More outcomes mean more judgment, means more time and effort. Humans experience the cognitive costs of judgment as a slower decision-making process. We all have to decide how much we want to pin down the payoffs against the costs of delaying a decision. Some will choose not to investigate payoffs for scenarios that seem remote or unlikely. The credit card network might find it worthwhile to separate work trips from vacations, but not vacations to Rome from the Grand Canyon. In such unlikely situations, the card network may guess at the right decision, group things together, or just choose a safer default. But for more frequent decisions, such as travel in general, or ones that appear more important, such as high net worth customers, many will take the time to deliberate and identify the payoffs more carefully. But the longer it takes to experiment, the longer it will take before your decision-making is performing as well as it could. Figuring out payoffs might also be more like tasting new foods. Try something and see what happens. Or, rather, in the vernacular of modern business, experiment. Individuals might take different actions in the same circumstances and learn what the reward actually is. They learn the payoffs instead of cogitating on them beforehand. Of course, because experimentation necessarily means making what you will later regard as mistakes, experiments also have costs. You will try foods you don't like. If you keep trying new foods in the hope of finding some ideal, you are missing out on a lot of good meals. Judgment, whether by deliberation or experimentation, is costly. Knowing why you are doing something. Prediction is at the heart of a move toward self-driving cars and the rise of platforms such as Uber and Lyft, choosing a route between origin and destination. Car navigation devices have been around for a few decades, built into cars themselves or as standalone devices. But the proliferation of internet-connected mobile devices has changed the data that providers of navigation software receive. For instance, before Google acquired it, the Israeli startup Waze generated accurate traffic maps by tracking the routes drivers chose. It then used that information to provide efficient optimization of the quickest path between two points, taking into account the information it had from drivers as well as continual monitoring of traffic. It could also forecast how traffic conditions might evolve if you were traveling farther and could offer new, more efficient paths en route if conditions changed. Users of apps like Waze don't always follow the directions. They don't disagree with the prediction per se, but their ultimate objective might include more elements than just speed. For instance, the app doesn't know if someone is running out of fuel and needs a gas station. But human drivers, knowing that they need gas, can overrule the app's suggestion and take another route. Of course, apps like Waze can and will get better. For instance, in Tesla cars, which run on electricity, navigation takes into account the need to recharge and the location of charging stations. An app could simply ask you whether you are likely to need fuel or, in the future, even get that data directly from your car. This seems like a solvable problem, just as you can tweak the settings on navigation apps to avoid toll roads. Other aspects of your preferences are harder to program. For instance, on a long drive, you might want to make sure you pass certain good areas to stop and eat. Or the fastest route might tax the driver by suggesting back roads that only save a minute or two but require a lot of effort. Or you may not enjoy taking winding roads. Again, apps might learn those behaviors. But at any given time, some factors are necessarily not part of a codified prediction to automate an action. A machine has fundamental limitations about how much it can learn to predict your preferences. The broader point for decisions is that objectives rarely have only a single dimension. Humans have, explicitly and implicitly, their own knowledge of why they are doing something, which gives them weights that are both idiosyncratic and subjective. While a machine predicts what is likely to happen, humans will still decide what action to take based on their understanding of the objective. In many situations, as with Waze, the machine will give the human a prediction that implies a certain outcome for one dimension, like speed. The human will then decide whether to overrule the suggested action. Depending on the sophistication of the prediction machine, the human may ask it for another prediction based on a new constraint. Waze, take me past a gas station. Hard coding judgment. Ada Support, a startup, is using AI prediction to siphon off the easy from the difficult technical support questions. The AI answers the easy questions and sends the difficult ones to a human. For a typical mobile phone service provider, when consumers call for support, the vast majority of the questions they ask have also been asked by other people. The action of typing the answer is easy. The challenges are in predicting what the consumer wants and judging which answer to provide. Rather than directing people to a frequently asked questions area of a web page, Ada identifies and answers these frequent questions right away. It can match a consumer's individual characteristics, such as past knowledge of technical competence, the type of phone they are calling from, or past calls, to improve its assessment of the question. In the process, it can diminish frustration, but more importantly, it can handle more interactions quickly without the need to spend money on costlier human call center operators. The humans specialize in the unusual and more difficult questions, while the machine handles the easy ones. As machine prediction improves, it will be increasingly worthwhile to pre-specify judgment in many situations. Just as we explain our thinking to other people, we can explain our thinking to machines in the form of software code. When we anticipate receiving a precise prediction, we can hard code the judgment before the machine predicts. Ada does this for easy questions. Otherwise, it is too time-consuming, with too many possible situations to specify what to do in each situation in advance. So for the hard questions, Ada calls in the humans for their judgment. Experience can sometimes make judgment codifiable. Much experience is intangible and so cannot be written down or expressed easily. As Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson wrote, "Substitution of computers for people is bounded because there are many tasks that people understand tacitly and accomplish effortlessly, but for which neither computer programmers nor anyone else can enunciate the explicit rules or procedures. That, however, is not true of all tasks. For some decisions, you can articulate the requisite judgment and express it as code. After all, we often explain our thinking to other people. In effect, codifiable judgment allows you to fill in the part after then in if-then statements. When this happens, then judgment can be enshrined and programmed.